This is Sam Sebring. I'm out at Full Moon Resort in Big Indian for a weekend of activities designed to raise awareness about pure water and clean water and how important it is to all of our lives and the threats that we face with natural gas drilling, hydrofracking process that's very dangerous and is contaminating a lot of water supplies. And I'm going to now walk out to the beautiful stream, and Matt Bua is here building a shelter that he's going to actually live in tonight. I think the temperatures are going at least down into the teens, if not more. I'm gonna walk out here. Snow's about a couple feet deep. Approaching Matt's area by the stream. I hear some hammering.
Deep in the womb.
Wow.
Regressing quickly back. See, there's a little altar here for the night lights and the candles and the Ave Marias.
Man, this is just fantastic.
Make my level sleeping quarters. That's the trick, you know. You don't want to have a bumpy sleeping spot.
Right. And it's also, it feels pretty warm in here, actually, surprisingly.
It's warmer, you know. I haven't installed the door yet. That'll be the key. Yeah, but we'll see. It's a beautiful night. Beautiful night for an igloo. Igloo sleeping.
Would you say this is based on an igloo design?
No, I would say it's one of those survivalist, you get to a spot, you got a couple of hours of daylight, and can you make a spot quick enough that you can sleep and not freeze? So it's more of a, you know, quick, you know, you're still using the snow as insulation, but they're cutting blocks of ice out and really stacking them up. And then what they do is the lady goes in with the whale oil lamp and they get it really, really hot in there. And then they open the door and all this cold air blows in and it just like fuses the whole thing together. And it's also nice and domed, so all the, you know, moisture goes down the walls. It doesn't like drip down. It just follows the seams.
Right.
So I am far from an igloo right here.
Right, but this is, you haven't been here that long, and you've already got quite a shelter here with a roof and essentially made with a, just to describe it to people, it's sort of a network of some tree branches that you've made kind of a grid and assembled a sort of a loose-knit roof here.
The key was finding the hill, you know, just so that when the wind blows, it's basically going to blow right over the top of me, so that's kind of...
Right, you're kind of nestled in here at the edge of a stream and a bank,
yeah.
Sort of, that makes a natural hill for your structure. And then are you going to have a fire in here?
I do have the, like, little, the ventilation holes right above here, but, I mean, for now it's... It's just candles, just to kind of see if it's a small enough space, if I can just heat it with that. Finding firewood in the middle of the winter is a little trickier. You know, you can pull dead branches off trees and stuff. But I don't know. The candles might just do it. But the key is, for you kids out there, make sure you got your ventilation so you're not, like, you know, suffocating yourself with whatever, the bad candle air. But it's also, the candles will go underneath this rock, so slowly the rock will absorb the heat. So even after the candles are out, whether I can make it so that that rock can then emit, what's that called, radiate heat.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, kind of part of the plan. But
kind of an improvised radiator there.
Yeah, because at least, you know, if when you're little house in the prairie, you heat the rocks up on the cook stove, and then you take them to bed with you, and you kind of have that little, little love rock. So, yeah, those kind of things.
Awesome, man. All right, well,
you'll have to check back in with me in the morning to see if I made it.
Anyways, the Feca Alta Vista is like the Moosic Mountains that's on the way to Scranton from Marysburg. And they have a large alpaca herd where Charles, the dyeberry weaver Blanchard, gets his spun wool. He also has some silk panels that are over there.
And this one's silky. You really have to touch these to get the full effect.
But mostly I think he enjoys working with alpaca fibers. But this farm, Finca Alta Vista, will be the first farm that's in the frack shed that will be impacted by hydraulic fracturing and gas drilling once the DRBC regulations go through.
That beautiful weavings here are made from these animals that are probably going to be drinking water that may end up being contaminated.
And dying. And they're like 15, 20,000.
I like water. Cool. I like art.
Yeah, well.
So, on a roll, on a mission to educate people. And, I mean, they have opened up their home to people have come in from Germany, film crews from Germany and other countries to in England and stuff doing documentaries because fracking's happening all through. Well, will be happening in Europe. But
it's a premiere up there in London, right?
Yeah, and he's been in Australia, and I hope someday he'll go to Poland because there's a fellow from Facebook that I talked to in Poland. We exchange a fair amount of stuff.
So how warm does your sleeping bag go to?
It's a double. It's 2-ply. I brought 2 sleeping bags and some wool blankets.
Because I was listening to NPR as I was driving over, and they kept announcing how low it's going, I think to 0 tonight.
I don't know. Then it's going to get up to 30 tomorrow. I don't know. If you would have said the Weather Channel, I would have been scared. But since you say NPR, that makes me feel like I'm not worried.
And in the area that was not licensed or permitted to have radioactive waste, so somehow they figured out to move it elsewhere in this one landfill site, but I still think it's illegal.
This is, you're talking about fracking waste.
It's called the drill cuttings or drill mud. It's from when they bore the original hole. And they're bringing back radioactive material from, you know, the thousands of feet down that they're drilling. And it's being trucked to some of the landfills in New York. Companies, I think some might also be going to Ohio on trains mixed in with sawdust, and they're also pulling a lot of water out of Ohio and other states for fracking in PA. There's so many wheelings and dealings going on. It's very shady in my mind. And again, they pushed through before people knew enough to be able to follow, to know what they're tracking, to make sure permits, you know, match up at landfills. I mean, some town boards, you know, have gone ahead because it looks, again, like that economic boom for the crisis that they're going through, but they're going to end up paying through the nose for all the road damage that's going on. And these companies skate so fast on any responsibility. I mean, in some townships, I know they have gone in and paved their roads, but I think it's really more so that their rigs can get through there. They're not doing it for the benefit of the community. It's really to ensure that their drivers can get through.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is why the dinner tomorrow is the frack shed dinner. So all the food that's being eaten tomorrow night, if the drilling goes in, all these farms will probably go out of business.
Wow.
And they're all organic farms.
Well, this
with CSAs.
Organic farming is the biggest growing industry in the state. So
people need to understand that consumers that are paying premium prices for local organic produce and meat or eggs, anything, cheese.
And how much is
basically be boycotted?
Wiped out. And a lot of the food that's grown up in some of these counties goes down to Philly and New York City.
Fortunately, the forces that are lining up for the gas industry
but also probably the forces behind the agribusiness industry that wants to distribute agriculture.
That's where the Halliburton Cup is going to be in Pennsylvania.
Oh, the big.
And the thing about it is that because to clean up the stuff that's in the Hudson, you'd have to dig out, dredge out all these PCBs. You have to dig them out. And they're doing
it.
Not
in the city.
But you can't get it all.
Yeah, I mean, this
you know, do y'all know about PCBs, like why they're so terrible?
More snow than we have, to be honest.
So PCBs were in everything. They were like the chemical sawdust. It's GE. Yeah.
GE.
Yeah.
It's been a solid winter.
Whatever those letters are. But GE did it. And because PCBs were kind of the chemical sawdust of, you know, 1930s to 1960s. Just because they're incredibly chemically and physically stable. So you can put them through, like, pair them with a lot of different chemicals, and they don't change. And run them through a gamut of heat or whatever, they don't change. So they insulate cathodes and all that kind of stuff. So they're everywhere. But because they're so chemically and physically stable,
all the way out in Meredith.
You can't get them out.
This farmer was telling me they
you can't, like, bioremediate them or
anything. Yeah, they don't go away.
No, they don't go away. They're just stuck there. And they're awful. They're awful. And the thing about the Hudson River is that the amount of degradation that you would have to expose that river to just to dig that stuff out.
Some people think it's better just to even not touch it at all.
I mean, there's a level of exposure even touching the sediment.
Right, but, you know, but if they start dredging the amount that they're just going to, like, kick up.
Yeah, and they have, like, sediment fences and that kind of stuff, but I mean, there's
horses are really interesting. Really
it's really problematic because
they have
it's really aggressive. Think about it. It's really, really aggressive, and there's an amount of aggression that you need to have, but there's an amount of aggression that's too much.
Right, so, like, removal as much as possible.
Yeah, remove as much as possible, but you can't get every ounce of it. And those fish are affected.
Every day I have to get her at 9 o'clock.
They're dealing with it the best they can, you know, but it is an unreasonable risk for people to eat it, and that's the really terrible thing about subsistence fishermen, is that they don't have a choice. And this whole, like, fish consumption advisory is the stuff that I work on. But fish consumption advisory, as they say, is geared mostly towards sports fishermen, right? And so they're like, oh, they're not gonna eat this fish, you know. And they give you these really complex temporal, you know, segregations of when you should eat these fish. And they don't show you the pictures of the fish, but they use the name. If you're from a different country, how are you going to know the name of the fish? And, like, the different water bodies and how much you should eat them, women and children, this amount of weight. They don't really talk that much about how you can prepare it differently, all this different kind of stuff. And but they don't give them an alternative. They don't say... The doctors all over the world say eat all this lean source of protein, fish, even though it's unsustainable. That seems critical that I can't eat this, and I'm catching it, and it's this really psychological, amazing benefit to go out there and catch food for your family, for yourself.
Or they'll tell you only eat so many fish. You know, like, oh, it's all right to eat, you know, one fish a week.
Yeah, you can eat tuna once every month or something.
But they really don't stress, and it's really weird. But you, if you eat that one fish that has that warning, you can't eat anything until the next month. So they say, like, oh, but I only ate one tuna, therefore I can eat one halibut, therefore I can eat one this. And so it's really complex.
It's a bottom feeder. It's a flounder. That one I can eat three of.
No, it's really too complex, and they have to fit this bureaucratic, you know, criteria of, like, I covered this part because, you know, CYA and from the health department. Cover your own ass, right? And that's fine because they've got to. But, like, I'm in a position for a nonprofit where I can go out and I can say, really talk to these people, and, you know, have to fit particular criteria and things I need to cover. I just need to say, I'm going to empower you with this knowledge and not try to colonize you and say you shouldn't do this. But they'll say, what's my alternative? And we're working with Massachusetts Avenue Project to get that alternative.
That's amazing about that project, because it's getting so much
information. I have the biggest crush.
It's giving, like, jobs to people. It's teaching them stuff.
And how to go.
I have the biggest crush on Massachusetts Avenue Project.
Oh, I forgot to ask you about the opening. Excuse me.
I think that's an incredible model.
And they're all youth driven.
You're never going to make it.
I mean, they empower the youth in the community. I pay them. And they teach them, like, web development.
Her husband's been disappeared.
Wow. Yeah. An enterprise.
Yeah, Kevin was in Dallas.
They're incredible.
These guys are pretty slow.
That's my story.
Don't you have something happen that you can't fix? These
that's how you... What? You want me to not sell my land off to this gas company, but you give me no economic alternative. How are you going to move a movement forward like that? I mean, honestly, how would you do that? And these are the questions that aren't being answered, that are the hard questions. In our quest for environmental protection, we have to address the economic stability of the communities that have been caretaking these environments for hundreds of years. And it's not just here. It's probably in any rural setting that you live in this country has actually been maintained, the taxes have been paid, the people that have put their livelihood into this have not just put their livelihood into it for 10 or 15 or 20 or even 50 years. We're talking about people who put their entire 200 years into these pieces of land that we are no longer producing crops off of. We're no longer producing livestock off of. We're no longer producing manufacturing off of. We're no longer doing anything from it. What we're doing is we're sitting on it and we're saying, well, You should give up your investment. That's a pretty bad investment, isn't it? If I invested 200 years of my time in something and all my taxes, and for most part, my men, my boys that had to fight your wars, and now I'm supposed to sit back and the last thing that I got here is a corporation who's willing to give me enough money that I'm not going to have to worry for the rest of my life. And now I'm supposed to not do that because you don't want me to do it. But you've been here 20 years, 10 years, 5 years, or you're not even here at all. Now, if you can't address those issues, I don't see the political relevance of this, and I don't see how you're going to move it forward. I really don't. And I know this is this tough stuff and nobody wants to talk about because these are the things that you have to say to yourself, well, what do we do? And it's not, and like I said, it's not just the Catskill Mountains. It's all over this country right now. But these are the things that have led up to why we're having to deal with this. as the country has become more urbanized, as people flock to cities and they earn pseudo amounts of wealth out of these cities, what they've forgotten is that the largest portion of the land we own in this country is rural. And unless you're a pseudo corporation, you didn't earn billions of dollars off of it. So when you want to come in and tell somebody, well, you pay taxes on this for all your life, but now you can't use it, or you can't sell it, or you can't do this, or you can't do that, most likely it's not even going to be constitutional. It's not even going to be able to be sustainable. Because it's not even based in the law that's written that covers what we're doing. So we've got to start, I think sometimes I love movements, but what I don't love about movements is the fact that you've got to start at a base. You've got to start somewhere where it's a real, where it's really deals with the real issue. And the real issue is, if you actually were to say to people, 4,000 people in my town, get everybody in that town together and say to them, listen, here's what you have to do. You have to figure out how you're going to take the 4,000 people in your town, and you're going to create an economy.
I'm joining you guys.
Fishnet.
Like I said, I'm ready to dress it out.
I told you you had to dress and drag.
Oh, my fishnets. I left my fishnets at home.
Do you guys know anything about the Snowflow skiing group that's here? And they're wearing these white suits and skiing down the mountain today.
I do not. Are they out there?
They're out there.
I haven't seen any of them, but...
We were just here to record it, hopefully catch them coming down the mountain, but I'm not seeing them. I'm wondering if I missed them or didn't know if you guys knew about this. Or
I don't, but you know what? If you go into the administration office, somebody there may know like what trail they're on and where they are. Okay. And if I have... If I happen to see them out there, I'll radio to the summit, and maybe they can, if you guys are right here, they can find you. All
okay.
Right? Hook up with them.
All right.
Okay?
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi. Do you know anything about the Snowflow skiers that were going to be here today?
They're gathering at the Longhouse Lodge, which is the next lodge to us.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I was going to try to catch them coming down the mountain.
Onondaga at 1:30, Ivy. Onondaga
at 1:30.
They're running a little late. So I would go over to the Longhouse Lodge.
Okay.
See what's going on.
Okay. Thanks. They all said go over to the Longhouse Lodge. They're running a little late, but they're on the dock at 1:30.
Isn't it past 1:30?
Yeah.
But they're running late.
Okay. So should we go next door?
Did you pick that up here?
Yeah, I mean, you can have it. I'm going to throw it away. Keep your eyes peeled for having a locker.
Pure.
Especially had a guy that just did a whole video interview of us and asked me a whole bunch of questions.
It's getting hot in here. I want to roll in the snow.
More documentation on the snowflow event, which is cool. I've been taking a lot of video as well with his head cam and getting lots of questions and what the hell's going on.
That is stellar. I am so impressed.
So we'll see how it goes. I think I'm out of juice with it right now. But
You guys looked really professional there.
Yeah, we worked on it.
So did you have any conversations with people today while you're out here wearing those suits?
Yeah, we spent the morning talking to a lot of folks who are interested and curious as to why we're wearing these suits. And we got a lot of people interested in volunteering. A lot of people had already heard of hydrofracking.
Ah.
Didn't really have a lot of information about it. But they were excited to participate.
So it was a good way of getting some awareness out here to some people that might not otherwise be exposed.
Yeah. People came from all over. People came from Long Island. Talked to one woman from Pennsylvania. People came from Western New York as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was generally well received. People were very excited. Everyone was very jazzed by the performance part of it.
All right, we're rolling.
When the water turns brown in the country New York town, the people are out for Aquafina. They sip from the glass, take a whiff, smell the gas, saying so long to the clean way. Money for the big guys drilling into our lifeline. People out there turning water into life. I flow back way, start to drum roll. Death rate, toxic sludge, all the animals.
That's excellent.
Thank you.
I'm good, this is fine.
Speak in animal tongues. Right. Tell me when to start. In toili kantoi, ampoi kaini kolani inkolana umpi taini kolom. Biti kona ona iki ona lini tona monkey kan. And rang or yango or nyangi kornai karno ma kaini rangi kom. Mawao ni kandoi in wawangi kandi wani lanti coin. Biti kono o kantini o maniki o nalini nom.
Do you
want me to sing one thing? I komo ani kominan o kono ini ano ini non. O como ini ano imi non. I como ani kominan. O como ini ano imi non. O como ini ano imi non.
So that's animal tongues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Perfect. It's snowing outside. Good. Is it? It's snowing outside. And oh, I'm going to have you write your names, please. And I also have a project, the Marcella Show Water Project, that I've been focusing on for quite some time and about to launch the interactive site.
Wow.
And then you could share the upcoming meeting and photographs.
I'd love
and
to.
You could even record your voice and upload it on the site. And then there are Trailer Talk audio and video. And it's about to, so I'm going to send a mailing off in the next week with the link and, you know, inviting people to please join and spread the word, because I it's a way to really continue to give a voice and a face to what's happening throughout the region, which is so critical. And then, of course, nationally and globally, I mean, but if we can start with our neighborhoods and what's happening and what it means and really be a voice for that.
You know, she's a very respected economist and is coming out with well-researched numbers that show a lot of what's wrong with hydrofracking.
They're going to swift boat her.
They want to swift boat her, yeah. They're coming out in numbers to heckle her and try to diminish her,
is
her standing.
Name
Jeanette Barth?
No, your name.
Oh, my name? Oh, yeah.
To call it a political issue to me is completely missing the point. It's that the politicians and the regulatory agencies do the bidding of the corporations and not the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, something like Egypt is really inspiring. I keep thinking, what would I like to see, what would the revolution in America be that I'd like to see. What would it be?
What are some of your thoughts about that?
Where people would say, you know, we're not going to allow the people that we elect to office to be doing the bidding of the corporations. We were talking about Monsanto on the way here.
Oh.
Organic farming, you know, drilling for fossil fuels. I'm pretty sure that if it's not half of the population, it's more than that. People want things to be different. They want, if they know about the planet, if they're not hoodwinked into thinking that there is no such thing as climate change, they want to do what they can to make this a better world. But they don't have a voice. The voice and the power is given to the corporations because, you know, of a lot of things like campaign finance, you know, but it's just, it's not the people who have a say. And that's what I object to. And this is just a sample of that. That we have our homes, we have things we want to preserve, but the industry gets to make the decisions. But as we go along, as time progresses, more and more people learn the truth. And I like to say that, and I've said it to Pat, that the corruption can't happen if it has to happen in secret. And the more people have information, and the deeper the information, and the more they're exposed, the less power they can have.
Well, you know, this could be a political issue, but in this case now, it's transformed into a moral issue. This is the time, the place, where the people, and this is the place where it's going to happen. We draw a line, and we need to not budge when it comes to our water, and our air, and our children. Mm-hmm. We don't budge, and the industry is beginning to get it right now. The industry knows they're bottled up in Trenton, and we're going to keep them bottled up. And the longer we do it, the more it'll be seen around the world. You know, we got emails yesterday from South Africa. We're communicating with Canada. We're supporting people in Australia. We've been visited from folks in France. So this is something that we're exporting, like tobacco. But here is where we end the scheme. This is where it ends. This is historic, and it's real. And this is where we draw the line, and what Mark Ruffalo and Josh and others have been saying lately, and it's really inspiring to hear them say it, that this ends up being really the pivotal issue. This ends up being the pivotal time. We're the pivotal people. We're the people who press our democracy forward or not. We're the people who press our rights forward or not. And we're the people who press what's right with regard to various moral questions. Well, here, let me just say one thing in real fast. Any artist out there, if you're an artist of any type, this is it. Rise up. This is when we need you this year, now, finally, after 3 years, and we've got 2 or 3 more years now. 100 artists can change the world. We need the artists right now to step up. It's not about politics. It's not about science, even. It's not even about water. It's not even about gas. It's not even about energy. This is when the artists have to step up, and we have to provoke a reaction, like Gandhi, like Martin Luther King. It's time, though, here, we've got to do it together. And the way to do it is to be very creative and to be very sort of thinking outside the box. So I just send a shout out to artists who can create a whole new sort of dimension here, even beyond moral and political issues. So you artists, just think on the blank canvas and how it is we're going to draw this picture that we need to draw of what's really happening here. And get to work this year and beyond.
There is a huge surge of interest in artists working with living entities. So there is a term, bio-art, and you're going to be seeing it more and more. And it's artists understanding that our relationship with other living entities is probably the most significant and crucial component of human sustainability. And they're addressing it very directly, both in terms of whole entities like plants, trees,
yes,
mammals, insects, but they're also doing it genetically on the microscopic scale. Cellular experimentation is even being done by artists.
And are you finding that this is in the United States?
I find an artist in these cultural outposts, and they have no idea they are part of a worldwide movement. And they think they are isolated and alone, and they've just felt this impulse to do something for their societies. And it's been really amazing to say, you've got colleagues all over, you're in a situation where you support each other. And I think we do need this kind of critical mass. You know, one isolated genius is not going to change the world. But if we have our most creative people in our society, we would count among them the artists devoting themselves to problem solving regarding the environment. Maybe there is hope. And the other part of art, of course, is that it's not just done for the pleasure of the creator, but it's offered as a social gift, a gift to the culture. And so whatever the artist does filters through the culture and has public hearing.
And what impact are you finding? Let's bring us right now. Here we are, Ulster County, the Catskills Snowflow event.
Well, this is an art project. This is such a perfect little snippet of what new art looks like. It's outreach, it's involving neighbors, it's getting the producers with the consumers, it's reconsidering the whole nature of our ecosystem, our habitats, and how we can survive well on the earth. And so it is exactly. So this is an art project, whether you, and you know, it doesn't even matter whether people who come know it's art, because it's going to serve us one way or another. But as far as I'm concerned, it's totally in the category of the art I've been talking about.
Because about the interaction and about the impact that that art and the artist can have on the movement.
Right.
And that's something that I'm sure you're discovering
so
more and more.
Forever I'm asked, but this isn't what art is supposed to be. And I guess we all who are working in this manner in the art field are pretty much on the defensive. But I think we've got so many ways of demonstrating that artists have always dealt with crucial issues of their time, whether it was serving the monarchy or some religious entity. And now we've got a big problem, and artistic energy is being directed there, and I think it's doing profound good for our culture.
Well, thank you so much, Linda.
So
it's fantastic.
Dealing
with so many things. It's Snowflow, celebration of water. It's dealing with
farming,
the food shed, about gas drilling, the Marcellus Shale, about water, about our homes, neighborhoods,
well, I think
interaction.
Linda, you know, following Linda, I think it does, we look at this as being a creative art project. I mean, we're really serving a conduit here to bring people together that are all very passionate about these issues, that are engaged in environmental issues. They're farmers, they're activists, they're artists, but they, you know, they often are pursuing these disparate kind of directions, and they're not, they can't come together to kind of see how they're working, how they could work together in different ways. And so we call these as being celebrations of the celebrations, where people can come together over good food, good conversation, art, music, and to become something that's much bigger than any one particular voice could have. And so people are here from the city, people are from Buffalo, people are from Ithaca, people are from the Delaware River, they're from the Hudson River, they're coming from all different areas with this common theme of water, right? And water kind of connects us all in some ways. But what will happen is some people aren't familiar with the hydrofracking issue, and like Linda, for example, felt uncomfortable talking specifically about that, but she's going to come away being kind of impassioned and kind of wanting to be involved in these kind of events in the future, right? So people get engaged because of these kind of events. They see that there is this kind of, you know, it's a pretty historic time, and I think that the people that are engaged in this really feel very, you know, proud of the work that they're doing.
And also realizing that there is a critical mass that already exists in the community, and that there's a common issue and a common goal that's intrinsic within in the current, you know, historic moment, shall we say. And I think Brooklyn was like that in the mid-90s, and SPAC Mellon was a product of that. And being able to be a cohesive body was an honor. And it's the same feeling doing this with the water issues.
What time does dinner start? What time is dinner?
Now.
Soon.
Yeah.
Like 7?
Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you, too. They made the announcement? Okay, so, good. Please join me if you'd like, and then we'll have dinner.
All right.
Which will be perfect.
This
is Alex.
Yes. My art is, you know, I view art as communication and as a way to share with other people a vision that, or you know, to communicate something that I see, an observation, and I've been doing collage work recently, or directly related to fracking and to the landscape, and I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania in a town called Fleetville. I'm not living there currently, but I've been heading out there, getting involved, and...
Where is that?
This is in... It's about a half an hour north of Scranton. It's, it's a lake region. It's about 35, 40 minutes from Damascus, east of Damascus.
Okay.
And they're currently in the seismic testing and exploratory well stage. And it's, I spent my youth on a lake house there, which my father still owns. But, yeah, I spent my entire childhood up there in the summers. My father was a school teacher, and he had summers off, and I would swim in the lake all year round. And to go up there now, there are helicopters flying around and cables running across the road every couple hundred meters.
Yeah, those pink boundary lines, the orange.
Exactly.
Tape, the cords. That's what, you know, until I went to, it was actually, a year, I don't know when it was, maybe a year and a half ago or so when I went to Dimmock. First time I went there and saw and heard the helicopters and all of that pink boundary tape and the orange cords and the signs everywhere and the white company trucks in all different sizes. It's happening.
That's what's happening there right now, yeah. The truck traffic has increased. There's the noise across the lakes. It's already, it's really changing already. And is in danger of really being compromised. Watching where I grew up and where my parents and my friends and family still reside really change is something I've been feeling a real call to get involved with.
So how are you getting involved, and how does it make you feel to see that the place that you grew up in and love is really under threat?
It's really hard to watch.
Yeah.
You know, this beautiful lake that I swam in every day for 10, 12 years, you know, the helicopters are flying over and they're clearing land for exploratory wells and, you know, in the watershed of the lake, things are going to change. In Fleetville, you have 70% of the people within the boundaries of the township have leased their land.
70%?
Yes. And you have a lot of people who are now realizing that they were lied to and that they were taken advantage of, and, you know, the companies weren't honest with them. And, you know, over the past 6-7 months of going to meetings, I've seen a lot of those people who originally would speak for the other side start to realize and bond together around the fact that they were mistreated and taken advantage of.
I grew up on an island on the St. Lawrence River, and I was a member from a fairly early age, or part of, maybe not full member, but environmental activism, specifically freshwater activism, has been part of my life since I was a kid. An organization called Save the River, which was started by Abby Hoffman when he was in hiding up in the Thousand Islands. He was in hiding down the road from where I grew up. And, yeah, no one knew it was him. He took the name Barry Freed, and he was living on Wellesley Island under the nose of all the local authorities, etc. He started this... he did not start. He co-founded with a number of local activists who were already sort of concerned about the shipping industry on the St. Lawrence River, this organization called Save the River. And in the time that he was underground, the FBI looking for him, all that kind of stuff, he testified before Congress as Barry Freed while the FBI was looking for him. The guy's guts are just amazing. I mean, he just was fearless. And so his effect was generational up in the Thousand Islands, up in northern New York. There's a whole crew of people who I would say, for the most part, would identify as maybe libertarian, not trustworthy, you know, don't trust the government at all, don't trust even environmental activists in a lot of ways, who are extremely active in terms of protecting that river. I grew up in the culture of that world. And so then the other thing, that was sort of the groundwork when I was a kid. And then as an artist, I went to the Art Institute in Chicago and came out of that with a whole group of people who were doing interventionist work, sort of tactical media strategy work, social practice. As we were talking, or as was being discussed earlier about, the art world changed and what we would consider art. In the sort of realm of Muriel Euclid, Laterman Euclid, and her maintenance art and projects like touch sanitation, I started to do things like shoreline cleanups as art practice. Mm-hmm. I started to hear about this fracking thing about 3 years ago from the same community of people who were, there's this thing called fracking, and at the time I was a Battlestar Galactica fan, and I was like, what are you guys doing up there? But as I figured it out, I realized, oh, that's awful. I get it. That's awful. I get it. So,
but it's a great word.
It's a really good word.
It describes something that's so awful. Yeah. I know.
It also so happens that my family has, sort of other side of my family lives on Skaneateles Lake in Onondaga County, which there are wells 2 miles from my parents' place on Skaneateles Lake. Skaneateles Lake, like the New York City watershed, is an unfiltered system that serves 300,000 people, and 2 miles from there are exploratory wells all along the ridge, Rose Hill Ridge. And so the more I started to read, the more I started to learn. I took a fall tour this year, it's an extension of something that Andrea set up this summer. It was actually Becca Economopoulos and her partner Jason Jones, who set up this fall foliage farming and fracking, I think it was called, tour. We came here and looked around, and the more I learned, the more I was like, okay, this is crazy. That every time I look at the numbers, clearly the long term effects, no one wants to talk about what's the downside to all the money people are going to make. And having grown up in upstate New York, I absolutely understand. There's not a lot, there's not a lot of income in central New York and western New York. I know these are some incredibly tough times in communities that have been suffering from depressions all the way back to the 60s. And so I absolutely understand when Chevron or Chesapeake or whatever comes handing out checks for $10,000, people jump on it.
Which should be illegal.
The crazy thing is how much of that money was subsidized, and that if that those federal subsidies had gone into, say, changing the farm bill so you use the food shed for food rather than for producing corn or corn oil for that matter, natural gas, etc. And that's where I think the thing that really became interesting to me is how this ties into food security in general. That the very same place that should be the food shed for Philadelphia, Boston, New York City, Washington, D.C., you're going to jeopardize by possibly ruining it forever. In terms of a food shed, watershed, it is absolutely tragic what we do without looking down, generations down the road.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
I understand the need to critique each other's strategies to fine-tune that, but really what we're talking about is not wasting our energy doing that. If what you want to do is get a bunch of artists into New York City and create something and fight for protecting the watershed, do it. And if I had money, I would give it to you. And I will give you, and I'll go there and show up for it. And if you want to call a ban in Buffalo. I mean, I got that article in Reuters. I personally called up somebody in Reuters. I wasn't out in Buffalo. I couldn't get out there. That was just too far for my schedule. But I got the article in there for you guys so that it's all across the country. That's what we need to be doing. Even if you don't agree with what this person is doing over here, you support them because they're just as pissed as I am, and they want to change it. That's what we need to do.
I think one thing that we've missed, and we seem to keep missing, is that drilling is just flat unconstitutional. And if you're going to deal with the right wing, you have to hit them on that level, because that's what they understand.
Good.
And that's right. And, you know, because we are guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we're not getting any of those three through health.
Yeah, Matt Bua upped the ante and made the snow shelter a real snow shelter for 2 days and lived in it. Matt, you want to say something?
Yeah.
Were you comfortable out there?
I was. I can't help but I felt a little spoiled to come in here for these decadent three meals and fatten myself up. And, you know, but the ground was starting to kind of creep up through my multi-layers of padding. So by the day two, it was like, my hips are a little cold.
Oh.
Wow. But, yeah.
That'll sneak up on you.
But now I know.
Been listening to the Nothing Is Real Radio Hour, recorded and produced by Sam Sebrin on every fifth Saturday for Free 103.9 and WGXC 90.7 FM hands-on creative community radio.
Well, is naturally growing food going to be one of those rare artifacts that will need to be preserved in a museum setting?